Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. Joe is scheduled to return tomorrow, just to give you that staff vacation calendar update. Joe is scheduled to return tomorrow. This morning, we are joined in studio by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good to see you. Also, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, is here. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning.
And Mark Whitman will be here momentarily. I have been informed that he was stuck behind a few, we'll call them bouts of construction on the way up from the Hudson Valley, and he will be here anytime. I told him, please do not worry about it and drive carefully. And I meant it. And I would always mean it to every panelist, Teresa.
Oh, man, it was tough getting in today.
And she came in barely fully out of breath because she was worried she was late.
It's
and she
Ray's
was not
fault.
Late. The log box is open, wamc.org. You can pledge anytime while you're on your computer or smartphone or tablet or other device. You can also email us, panel@wamc.org. Please do try to keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments. Don't use obscure abbreviations. And if you have a sec, proofread your email before you send it so your comments can be clearly read. Mark Whitman has joined us. Hi, Mark. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. Take your time. Catch your breath. I won't come to you again until you're settled in. Again, the email address, panel@wamc.org. That is the panel email address, and we are going to start this morning by talking about the temporary protection status of Venezuelan immigrants, which has been removed by the Supreme Court. Or rather, they have granted Donald Trump permission to remove the TPS protections from Venezuelans. Sarah, do you want to set this up for us?
Sure. So temporary protected status is a lot, unlike a lot of terms in immigration law, it is exactly what it sounds like. It's a temporary status that is a combination of a decision by the State Department and other branches of the executive that it's not safe for people to who are already in the United States to return to their country of origin. And you see this a lot of times with natural disasters or civil unrest that's particularly problematic. Some countries are granted TPS status and then it just keeps getting renewed time after time after time because it's still not safe for the people who are in the United States to return to their country of origin. It does not provide a permanent path to citizenship. So you have to find another way to get citizenship. And it's temporary, so it has to be renewed on a regular basis. You can work, typically, while you're here on temporary protected status. You have to apply separately for employment authorization. But this follows, of course, the deportation of Venezuelans to a horrible prison in El Salvador. And it seems that with that tied up in all kinds of lawsuits at this point, that stripping TPS, which is statutorily well within the power of the executive, as the Supreme Court has affirmed, that's another way to hasten the removal of Venezuelans from the United States. I have to point out that a lot of this is politicized. It depends a lot on what the State Department's view of a particular country is at any given moment. And, you know, for reasons, Donald Trump has Venezuela on his list of targets. So that's why we're seeing this come up. And, I would imagine that because he's having a hard time deporting as many people as he'd like to, that we can see challenges to other countries under temporary protected status going forward, especially given, I think it was last week or the week before, I lose track under Trump administrations because it's like every single week there's at least one or two things. But the end of temporary status of another kind for Afghan evacuees. So just another way that the executive has a lot of power in immigration, and another attempt by the Trump administration to deport as many people as possible.
The decision yesterday will strip 350,000 Venezuelans of their TPS, their temporary protected status, and the high court order appears to be the largest action in modern American history, stripping any group of non-American citizens of their immigration status. Teresa?
Yeah, so I read in the story that Sauer, the Solicitor General John Sauer, told the justices that, and I'm reading this, people affected by ending the protected status might have other legal options to remain in the country because of the, quote, decisions to terminate TPS is not equivalent to final removal order. But to me, that raises the question of whether or not the Trump administration has any real infrastructure for properly processing these folks, because I know when the Biden administration tried to get increased funding to do that, to process people, to deter, make a actual due process determination, they couldn't get the bill passed that had that funding. And so and I couldn't find anywhere whether or not they are funding this. I see where they're funding detention centers and such. But do you know if they're funding any processing, Sarah?
Or? Well, in fact, they're firing people process claims, including immigration judges. So typically, a removal order is issued by an immigration judge because there are still some vestiges of due process in the immigration system where the executive will acknowledge it. There should be more. They should be better protected. But in this country, we detain and deport first and ask questions later. So, you know, this is a deliberate move by the Trump administration to reduce the number of decision makers that we have so that they can deport as many people as possible. It's harder to get back into the country once you've been deported. The Solicitor General is not wrong. There may be other paths for folks. This is another when the president of the United States makes a very public showing of what will happen to you if you are taken into custody by the federal government, i.e. you'll be sent to a human rights violation, just open and notorious place for a scary, scary place for people to go to, then people tend to avoid that at all costs, meaning people will likely, some people may choose to voluntarily depart, which you can take in lieu of a final removal order. It has fewer consequences for, it has a shorter timeline for when you can reenter the country, and it means people can leave on their terms as opposed to the government's. Allegedly, theoretically, who knows what he'll do?
I check always on when I'm going to be on what's happened on this day in history. And in 2018, that's when Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela won his second term, and now and under questionable circumstances, right? And there were boycotts, suggestions of vote rigging, and now he's won again. And so the situation hasn't improved in Venezuela; it's only gotten worse. And so it's this issue in the United States of due process is obviously one that this administration, it's parts of the Constitution. Again, as I say, it's Constitution's not supposed to be a suggestion, but to this administration, it seems to be. The other thing I think, and you mentioned it, that I've been really concerned about is this Department of Homeland Security announcement of the Afghanis have to leave. And to me, this is the same group of people who constantly denigrated President Biden and his administration for how the U.S. left Afghanistan and specifically talked about how we left behind people who helped us. And so those people who did get here after helping us, they're now saying that they have to leave and go back to Afghanistan, which I think I'm just amazed at how little attention that has gotten, as well as this notion that there are another 500,000 Haitians who should be returned to Haiti at a time when we know that, Haiti is in quite a disarray, is putting it politely. I wonder, what is all this costing us? What is the process costing us in terms of real dollars? And what is the lack of process costing us in terms of adherence to our Constitution and how we're seen in the world? And the last thing, that Trump for a long, long time has talked about Venezuela, and I too don't understand what his thing is with Venezuela, but he constantly repeats this trope that the Venezuelans emptied their jails and mental health facilities and sent all those people to the U.S. with zero evidence that that ever happened. It didn't happen there's no evidence it happened in Venezuela. There's no evidence it happened in the Congo or the three or four other places. And yet the media repeats it and doesn't, you know, every time he says it, they should say, where's the evidence? Because what it does is scare people. And it's done with no evidence. So in any case.
Absolutely. And you mentioned two oil-rich countries, Congo and Venezuela, resource-rich, I should say. So I suspect that there's a connection between Trump's friends and their interests and then his decisions about these countries, his friends being Putin and other dictatorial regimes.
Mark?
So, well, I guess there are two issues I want to just briefly mention. One is Venezuela itself, and then this order and how I think it talks about where the Supreme Court's going to go for the remainder of Trump's term. On Venezuela, it's interesting if you think about the Biden administration and the last election down there in Venezuela. Biden administration, to my estimation, intentionally gave the Venezuelan government the benefit of the doubt and took all sanctions off, started to sort of make nice in order to keep oil prices down and increase their chances of having a Democrat reelected. So Trump is not the only one who's played footsie with the Venezuelans historically. Not that either of them should be, frankly. I'm not defending Trump when I say that. I'm just saying we should be more broadly aware of what happens politically. I think that idea of being more broadly aware is also helpful to explain what I think we're seeing with respect to immigration. The populace in America decided, particularly when it could see within cities that it hadn't seen them before, immigrants on the street, decided that it really did hate our immigration policy, or at least I should say the way we ran immigration, regardless of policies. They hated the effect of our policies and how it was being run. And they gave Trump a lot of support. Arguably, it was his second best issue in the election. And he is facing all sorts of lack of success on other measures. This is the one where the public generally is, I guess, less worried by what he's doing. And I think we shouldn't underestimate how much he, Stephen Miller, Christine Noem believe that this is pandering to his base and the racism that he stokes and the division that he stokes. And if there was any doubt, just look at the Afrikaners that he's let in and the ridiculous justification for that. If that isn't just race baiting, I don't know what is. Now, if you look at this specifically, my understanding is, and it's interesting to note that Ketanji Brown Jackson was the only dissent here. My understanding is it is the purview of the executive to turn on and off these stays of deportation for these large classes. And the Supreme Court basically, I think in this case, and I think we can expect for the remainder of Trump's term, I think it will defend the other two branches' authority rigorously. But I think in doing that, the trade-off is it's going to give Trump a pretty free hand in terms of executive powers and what he does with them. And I think this is a clear example of that.
You're the expert, but
go ahead, Teresa.
Go ahead.
No, you.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't disagree that he has the authority to determine temporary protective status. The executive has that authority. The part that I have trouble with is the next part, which is the due process part, that they are afforded, and even his own Solicitor General said that they should be afforded due process, and they've given no evidence that they are going to afford these folks due process. And the question is, why would you suggest that it's now safe to go back to Haiti? Haiti. Is there any evidence that, I mean, he has the right to say it is, but is there any clear evidence that says right now it's safe to go back to Haiti? I don't see it. Venezuela, you know, probably not, but certainly not Haiti. And how could you in good conscience say to those folks from Afghanistan who they came here, not nearly enough as should have gotten out, have gotten out, so they get out, they get here, and now, and they get here because they helped Americans during the war, right? And now he's saying that they no longer have protective status. They haven't been processed because of the backlog, because there aren't people to do it. And I also think that the reason that he riled up, Trump effectively riled up his base is because he scaremongered people. He said things over and over that weren't true, like the Venezuelans empty out their prisons and jails and made people believe that it wasn't safe to walk down the street because they were going to get killed by immigrants when there's very little evidence of that. So he did it by scaremongering. Well, I mean very, very, very effectively, no doubt about it, but he did it by scaremongering.
Yeah, Teresa, I don't disagree that the assertion by the Solicitor General that there are other means of redress is a weak fig leaf when you're taking hundreds of thousands of people and dumping them, trying to dump them back into Venezuela. I think we should expect that very few, if any, find success in other avenues. And I do agree that part of the reason the assault on irregular immigrants has been so effective is because it's been coupled with an erroneous assertion that we are left safe because they're in this country, which is just statistically not true. They commit crimes at a lower rate than citizens. So if we really want to make the country a lot safer, then we should all leave and leave the irregular immigrants here, and it'd be actually a safer nation than it is.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Gene wrote in and says, seems like Trump has a target quota of deporting millions and millions of illegals as he promised MAGA. Any living body will do, status be damned. That is from Gene. Panel at WAMC.org. We are up against a break and we'll return with more roundtable panel with Teresa Bourgeois, Sarah Rogerson, and Mark Whitman after this.
1-800-323-9262. Just a moment here, David Gustino, while we take a break and fill this lockbox, and then we'll get back to the panel. It has been a great morning already. We have in the lockbox as of this moment, and let me refresh just to make sure, $283,574. That's money we will not have to raise beginning on Monday, June 2nd. That's what the lockbox is all about. We won't pester you for the entire program. You'll get the roundtable panel in just a couple of moments. 800-323-9262. That's an important number. You'll be hearing it an awful lot over the next couple of weeks. That's the way you keep this station whole. You can also go to WAMC.org and make an online pledge. But David, it's never been more important than right now.
The climate in Washington is suggesting that both commercial and public stations may be in a bit of trouble, including directly affecting the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We still have to see where everything goes. People are standing up and fighting back, and we're, of course, reaching out to you to suggest ever so nicely and gently that with your support we can sustain this radio station into the future beyond any one of us. 1-800-323-9262. Now is the time to step up and put something in. And it is amazing when you listen to the quality of experts on our panel this morning talking. At least one issue I heard about Venezuelans when it comes to immigration. These are the kinds of conversations and debates in a civil way you're not going to get anywhere else. It just time and time again comes back to WAMC. While so much of the media has been lost because of cuts, because of layoffs, because of the inability to pay for the product that we make, WAMC has survived because of you. Because you are the shareholders in this company, and you come to us each and every time and say, hey, WAMC, here's my $5, here's my $10, here's my $10,000. Let's keep this thing going, and we need to do that right now. And for all of you that listen to the panel in the morning, this is a call to you. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. Together, all of us will make this station whole.
Sarah LaDuca is doing one heck of a job there in Studio A, and it's a nice panel. Teresa Bourgeois, Mark Whitman, and Sarah Rogerson, and we'll be getting back to them in just a minute or two here. But this station matters for a lot of reasons. Why does it matter to you? To me, it is a place where I can do my thing, if you call it a craft or whatever you call it. Some people call it much less than that. But for me, it has been a place that has been the foundation of my life. My family and everything else stems from here. For you, tell us what matters to you about WAMC and the independent broadcasting that we have been doing now for decades. And we'd love to hear it. You can put it in your pledge, WAMC.org. You can make an online pledge, 800-323-9262. If you have a comment, if there's no swearing, we'll read them, Dave Gustina.
That's right, because we at WAMC want to have an interaction with you. We want to exchange information. Maybe a little opinionated disagreements, but those things can be done in a way that grows our audience, that brings us together around common issues and goals. Like Anonymous of Albany, New York, checking in this morning. Two Anonymi from Albany, Ray, and Sue of Plainfield, Massachusetts. All over the listening area, the United States of WAMC, people are tuned in right now, and they understand the importance of it. Just one vox pop that I hear from Ray on a medical Monday where someone gets some kind of an answer that moves them forward with whatever diagnosis or ailment they have. I've heard it time and time again. These are the kinds of programs that we put together that inform, that educate, that entertain. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org, and right now you can help.
And this might not be that entertaining, and I apologize.
Oh, absolutely
but
not.
This is what we need to do to keep this station going. And it doesn't just mean keeping the lights on. It keeps the trusted journalism, the newsroom that, to me, is second to none in this region. It keeps the local voices on the radio. It keeps the Mark Whitman and the Sarah Rogerson and the Teresa Bourgeois and all the other roundtable panelists here. It fights back against censorship, disinformation, media consolidation. You get your arts programming here. It's all for free, and there's never a paywall at the website. But that's all good. But we need you to make it alive. 800-323-9262, WAMC.org. David Gustina, we have raised so far $283,774. Let's keep it rolling here. We're going to go back to the roundtable momentarily. Since you are so pithy, usually, why don't you, put the ribbon on it?
I heard that. Well, you know what? The point is that we here at WAMC are not here because we are trying to get rich. We work at a nonprofit institution because we believe in the mission of WAMC, and we all believe in that mission. We know that there's a larger meaning to all of this when we support our public station, WAMC.org or 1-800-323-9262.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. You can email us, panel@wamc.org, to join the conversation. Thank you to Ray and David Gustina for reminding you all to support WAMC whenever you can at wamc.org. The panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Sarah Rogerson, and Mark Whitman, we are discussing kind of a lot of immigration stories in the United States this morning, starting with the Supreme Court allowing President Trump to strip legal protections from 350,000 Venezuelans in the country. We are also now going to introduce the topic of the Justice Department has charged a New Jersey congresswoman with assaulting federal agents during a clash outside a Newark immigration detention center, and they dropped a trespass charge against the city's mayor that arose from the same episode. Alina Haba, the interim U.S. Secretary for New Jersey, disclosed the move, saying that the congresswoman, LaMonica McIver, has been charged for assaulting, impeding, and interfering with law enforcement when she visited the detention center with two other Democratic members of Congress from New Jersey on May 9th. Sarah.
Yeah, so the Trump administration is pushing how far it can go, not just for the due process rights of immigrants, but the due process rights of Americans. So now we see a creep into a couple of issues. You might remember back last month, the the Trump-led FBI arrested a state court judge from Wisconsin, Hannah Dugan, for what they claim was obstruction of justice when she referred ICE officials to the administrative unit of the courthouse and then allowed a defendant in her courtroom to use a separate exit from the building. He was ultimately apprehended by ICE agents shortly after he left the building, but she was charged with obstruction of justice. And last week she was in she had a hearing and was indicted by a grand jury. So there's also a case in Boston from the first Trump administration of a Boston state court judge. President Biden dropped the charges against her, similar facts, but the Massachusetts Judicial Ethics Committee is still noodling her case, which is like 7 years old now. But that's going to come up this summer. So we're looking at whether Trump can use immigration to also start silencing and targeting elected officials, including judges and in New Jersey, other electeds who he disagrees with philosophically or who might be political enemies. And that is something that I think groups like the Federalist Society should be really concerned about. You know, what happened when the conservatives and libertarians really hold dear this idea of state sovereignty and state rights and the separation, you know, the avoiding the big feds coming after state governments. This is laying a really dangerous precedent down the road for Republicans when the executive can start targeting state actors for free speech or for ideology. So, you know, it doesn't the criminal charges will probably be easily dismissed, but the damage is really in the message that Trump is trying to send to everyone who disagrees with him, including judges and elected officials. No one is safe.
Sarah, I get it that the way, particularly the way they arrested that judge, making a big to-do about it was regrettable.
Perp walk, yeah, and a, you know, a mugshot and everything else.
Right, whereas if you remember when the president was held to account for his actions, some of which he was eventually convicted of, he was asked to present himself. As opposed to they didn't go get him and put him in cuffs and arrest him. But with respect to the Wisconsin judge, isn't there still an open legal question as to whether or not she broke the law?
Because charges are pending, yes, but in fact, I don't know what I have to look up what the federal statute actually says for the elements of obstruction of justice, but I have a really hard time believing that anything that she did constituted obstruction.
Yeah, my understanding is that even the defense that they're going to use or that they've articulated is that she's got the right to direct people within her court however she wants, and the court includes the jury room. Effectively, the irregular immigrant used a jury exit.
Yep.
And the question is as to why. Why did she send him there? Was it just to avoid a kerfuffle in the hallway, or was it to help him evade arrest, which are two very different, you know, state of mind probably matters. But I get it. I mean, I think it's clear. And this decision by the Supreme Court is another one where we talked about at the beginning of the show where the lines, the delineation of what's legal and what isn't legal is one thing, but the intent of the Trump administration is pretty clear. I mean, just think of, I was thinking on my way in today, the woman who's head of Homeland Security is a woman who shot her pet dog and shot her goat for being a goat, right? I mean, literally, if you read the book, or my understanding of the book, I didn't read it, but is, you know, the goat was smelly and it was headbutting her children, so she shot it. If you think about, and Donald Trump, it's probably
let me tell you what you do with a goat that's doing that. You give it to someone else.
Well, or how about
that's been my experience.
You rehome the goat.
Or how about you put the goat in a pen because it's a goat.
Right.
I mean, and you keep tell your children unless they're large enough to defend themselves that they don't. And I mean, but my point is, I don't think the more I think about it, none of this is an accident. It is not an accident that he put somebody like her in charge of Homeland Security. The Afrikaners are not an accident. He's sending signals every day as to who he is and who his people are. And you don't have to look very far to get the clues.
Well, I think back to this New Jersey situation where, again, they were in Newark, New Jersey at this private prison that was being set up where the community did not want it there. The three members of Congress went. They had every right to be there. They patiently waited, what, an hour or two while there was a lot of back and forth. And only after phone calls did they end up having this altercation was created. And this notion that Alina Haba is the interim U.S. attorney from New Jersey. She was one of Trump's many personal lawyers who's now in positions of power in the Justice Department. This gets announced not through the Justice Department but on X, that's how this is for show. And the lines that I found most intriguing was when she said, "No one is above the law, politicians or otherwise. It's the job of this office to uphold justice impartially, regardless of who you are. Now we'll let the justice system do the work." And this is the same Justice Department. This is the same administration who released all of the people who have been prosecuted for January 6th. I know I harp on the January 6th issue, but these same people say no one's above the law when these folks were convicted in many cases of assaulting police officers, and they get released. And this member of Congress, and if you look at the video, they released a video that looks like maybe she might have pushed this person. But if you look at a separate video that the media that was available through the media, it appears pretty clear that somebody from behind her, there was a lot of pushing going on, and she got pushed from behind and went into this other person. And
Teresa, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we talked about it during the break, but for the listeners, can you set up the situation in New Jersey that you're talking about? Even I had trouble following it for a second to catch up with where we are.
I'm sorry. So three members of Congress from New Jersey Department of Homeland Security has opened a private prison detention center. An ICE detention center in Newark, New Jersey. And there was quite a controversy by the local community, the mayor, others, about whether or not it should be there. And so three members of Congress from that area went to tour the facility. They were initially not allowed in. They'd spent about, as I recall, maybe about 2 hours back and forth quietly waiting to be allowed to go in. The mayor wanted to join them. He was told he couldn't. He left. He went outside the gates. And then the ICE folks went outside to arrest him outside the gates. These three members of Congress went and they encircled him to prevent him from being arrested. And that's when a scuffle occurred. And there was, for just a few moments, there was a very, I don't know what you would call it, really disturbing scuffle between the ICE agents whose faces were covered and these three members of Congress. One of them is an 80-year-old person. And there was a lot of pushing and shoving. They were trying to protect particularly the elder person, and they encircled the mayor so that he wouldn't be detained. And then eventually the mayor was let out. He was arrested outside. The three members of Congress were allowed to go in, and eventually they did tour the facility. But this seemed to be somewhat of a instigated situation, and now they're charging, as of last night, they're charging this one member of Congress for quote-unquote assaulting and impeding, interfering with law enforcement. And it's really, I think, a stunning turn of events. And as Sarah says, this is meant to signal, that don't cross me. But I also think, and I belaboring this, but I would like to say, I think people also need to pay attention to the facility where they are, because I went down a rabbit hole last night. ICE has entered into a $1 billion contract with this company, the GEO company, to convert the building into a detention center. $1 billion. So at the same time, they're talking about how we have to cut housing programs in the United States. We have to cut food programs, Medicaid. $1 billion contract for this facility. And they've also entered into a similar contract in Michigan and I can't find the total number of costs, but the company says that they expect to have $60 million in revenues annually for the Michigan one. And then there's a third one as well. And interestingly enough, this same company, their lobbyist, was Attorney General Pam Bondi. And it turns out she failed to disclose the fact in advance of her hearing for to be Attorney General. She failed to disclose the fact that she lobbied for this country, as she failed to disclose her lobbying for Qatar. And so the ranking Democrat for the Senate Judiciary Committee on May 2nd sent a letter raising concerns about potential conflicts of interest. But here, millions of dollars are being spent on these detention centers.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We are up against a short underwriting break, but we will return exactly where we've left off after this.
Support for WAMC comes from Dwoleski's Tree Planting and Transplanting, NYSA ISA certified arborist, planting native trees and shrubs with various size tree spade equipment for transplanting in Columbia, Dutchess, and Capital District, DwoleskiTree.com. The Olana Partnership, guided tours of the historic landscape and house Tuesday through Sunday at Olana State Historic Site. New farm tour now available. The Frederick Church Center for Art and Landscape now open. Tours available Monday, May 26th, olana.org. Mostly Modern Festival, celebrating their sixth season at the Arthur Zankel Music Center, June 5th through June 20th in Saratoga Springs, New York. mostlymodernfestival.org. And Belvedere Home Care, Albany. Professionals working to provide caring and personalized home health care throughout the Capital Region. BelvedereHomeCare.com for info.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Our panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Sarah Rogerson, and Mark Whitman. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, and you can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Ahead of the break we just took, we were discussing the ICE Detention Center and various immigration contracts that have been funded by the government. Teresa Bourgeois was delineating those for us, and I would like to hear Sarah Rogerson's explanations, thoughts, etc.
Yeah.
Knowledge base. Tell us everything you know.
Geo Group and CoreCivic have had these giant, massive contracts with the federal government for decades. And they've been the subject of some exposés. They're pretty notorious in terms of certain detention facilities have been shut down because of human rights abuses and violation of fundamental human rights. Lots of horrible things happening in these detention facilities, including, you know, various forms of assault, including against children. So bad, bad companies. Everyone should, I know no one's looking at their 401k right now, but if you can venture in there and take a look at what you're investing in, chances are you're investing in one of these companies because they're just massive and they're everywhere. And so it's problematic for lots and lots and lots and lots of reasons, but it's also a signal that the Trump administration is planning to detain even more people. And when folks like elected officials in New Jersey protest and say, you know, not in our backyard, they get arrested. And that sends a message too. So you have these two messages. We're going to continue to lock up people that may or may not have done anything wrong, including children. And we are going to silence American citizens who speak out. It's interesting. One thing that I found when we were talking about the Afghanistan issue is that Fox News actually is covering ministers, faith-based groups who are reaching out to the Trump administration saying that Christian Afghan nationals who are here under temporary protected status, if returned to Afghanistan, will be targeted by the Taliban and killed. And so one of the rare silver linings of a Trump administration is that you do have untraditional allies. Faith leaders have always been allies to immigrant groups, but to have a conservative faith leader saying to President Trump, I fully support your deportation plan because we do not want criminals to live in the United States, but we have to be aware that among those people that you want to deport, some are not criminals. Some are people that are at risk of being killed, being imprisoned, losing their wives, losing their kids. So more of those voices need to come out of the woodworks if we expect to change any of this, because everybody else is just going to get arrested.
Can you speak to the people who've been sent to El Salvador who, the question is, as I understand, more than half of them probably did not commit the crimes that they had claimed, the government's claim that they did commit. Can you speak to that?
Sure. There are a lot of lawyers working on these cases. The allegations against those folks were that they had ties to a gang, and many of them do not. There was one, I think, who was a makeup artist and fashion designer who had a tattoo of a crown, which is one of the gang symbols, but the crown had to do with fashion. So, you know, those folks haven't had their trial, but again, they're detained first, and then the questions are asked later. So a group of human rights organizations have filed a lawsuit with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And folks may not be familiar with this, but this is where we go when the United States justice system fails. Another really famous case that went before the Inter-American system was a domestic violence case out of Colorado. It's sort of a lengthy explanation. I won't go into it here, but essentially, if countries are members of the Inter-American system, and the United States is, it's one of the few places where the United States can be held accountable in an international law jurisdiction. The Inter-American Commission can, you know, scold and embarrass the United States for what it's done. And, you know, that is a process that remains ongoing because United States law doesn't apply in El Salvador, except to the extent that there are international agreements that make things happen. So the Venezuelans who are stuck in El Salvador, each of them may have individual claims that have to be litigated elsewhere, but also you see human rights organizations filing a case in this Inter-American Commission on behalf of all of them to get the situation sorted out.
Just that situation with the gulag in El Salvador, it terrifies me for a couple of reasons, and Mr. Abrego-Garcia highlights that, which is the U.S. admits he shouldn't be there, but now says it can't get him back. So I think it's an open question as to what the U.S., the administration, and I think it's an open question as to what rights those folks still have. Their detention there has been termed indefinite. What exactly does that mean? Are they now there forever? I mean, are they going to die in that prison? We actually don't know the answers, and I think that shows you why the Supreme Court granted that emergency stay. I think it was even over a weekend when there were allegedly other flights being prepared to ship people down. And I think it was a 7-2 decision that the
yep.
Supreme Court, I mean, except for Alito and Thomas, which, you know, if they dissent, it's probably a good sign. You're probably on the right side of things, given those wackies. But the Supreme Court said, you're not going to fool us twice, which is you're not going to send these folks down there again and then put up your hands and say, well, we can't get at them. They're done. I mean, then why does that scare me? Well, that scares me even as a U.S. citizen, as our president muses about sending Americans there. And Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, had a great idea, which was you just designate a wing of Venezuelan prison as U.S. territory, and away you go. And it wasn't that long or that far away where the government of Argentina took people up in planes outside of their national borders and then just dropped them into the ocean. You know, and if our rights end at the water's edge, then what are we left with under this administration? I think that's why we all need to support, and those of us on the front lines need to fight for folks like Abrego-Garcia. I get it. He may end up here. He may be afforded due process and deported quickly. But we have to do these things the right way, because if we don't, the costs are potentially catastrophic.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, more than half of the people have looked into the backgrounds of those who've been sent to this prison in El Salvador and found that more than half of them, there's no evidence that they've committed a crime other than come to the country illegally, but no violent crime, no other crime. They've just come to the country illegally. And so what is the price tag for sending them? Again, because we're in this budget season and these Republicans say that they're trying to be, you know, save money. What is the cost of sending these people there on military planes? I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but it's exorbitant, like $23,000 an hour or something. And right now, there are, what, 30 people being held at Guantanamo at some phenomenal cost? And what are we paying? What is the United States, what is the Trump administration paying in our tax dollars to hold these folks in the prison in El Salvador? It's some enormous amount of money also, plus these $1 billion. I mean, this all adds up to real money. And what is it?
Yeah, Teresa, I agree, and I think it's worth discussing that. And I'm sure you won't disagree with this, but I do want to foreground the cost to all of us is the threat to our freedoms and our principles
and our
rights.
And our
standing. It's even within the country and just ethically and morally. I look back to the day after the election and I almost cried on air, and now I'm not ever going to apologize for doing that.
No. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center Sarah Rogerson, and investment banker on Wall Street. We will return after this.
1-800-323-9262. 10:06 on a Tuesday, and a lockbox challenge at that. And we're raising money little by little as we try to knock out as much as we can from the on-air fund drive on June 2nd. I'm David Gustini, here with Raymond Graff.
Hello.
And we have been tasked with trying to convince you, not an easy job, to pick up that phone or go online at WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, and put something into our lockbox. We are over 82,000-3,000 at this point.
Breaking news, David. We are at 292,285. So we're at $292,285. And if you're one of those people who have made pledges so far in this lockbox portion, I say it, I mean it, thank you. And you understand. And if you have a friend, maybe, who has never heard the station, you know, pass the word. Maybe we can grow this thing even more. But what you have done is magnificent. 800-323-9262.
1-800-323-WAMC. It is a lockbox challenge. The lockbox, a brilliant idea. It says, you know, we got this place where you can put your money and we'll add it up. And when we start on day one of the fund drive, June 2nd, we'll dump that money in and it'll knock at least at this point, I would say, Raymond, we're almost at 3 full days of an on-air fund drive right now with the amount of money we've raised.
Right. And this morning, while we have, you know, brief times, couple minutes here and there, we'll be back to the panel in a moment, we could actually hit the $300,000 mark in this drive in the lockbox well before the fund drive begins on Monday, June 2nd. If you haven't done it, let's do it. 800-323-9262. Or you can pledge online at WAMC.org.
And when you get there online, if you're worried, as we are, about support for public media, you can even contact your representative. We have a link there at WAMC.org. If you're worried about cuts from Washington that may impact public media, we have a link to give you an action point, a way to contact your representative and let them know how you feel. We here together make the United States of WAMC, and we can continue that now with a pledge at 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. How about the panel this morning? How about Morning Edition each and every morning? How about Ray Graff? How about Mike Bowen, our engineer, the unthanked, unsung hero of WAMC, who makes it all happen behind the scenes? So much more goes into this thing than you realize. And so many of us are believers in this mission that we cannot fail if we just turn that passion into action. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. My good friend Raymond Graff, I think we may be making progress.
We certainly are. Thanks to Carol in Plattsburgh, New York, says, I've been a long-time, lifetime listener. Don't have a TV. I run a business, so I'm busy. WAMC and NPR are the main source of news and entertainment. Listens to the panel, wait, selected shorts. It's an invaluable resource, says Carol. Not only is Carol a lifetime donor, she is a legacy donor. And Carol, thank you a million times. Thanks to Anonymous in Albany, who says, I didn't know they were sending Afghani back, and I heard it from WAMC. You hear a lot of stuff on WAMC that you're not going to hear in so-called mainstream media. This is a place of independent thought. This is a place, it's a common square of ideas where people all over the map discuss stuff without being mad at each other, and it's most of the time, and it's a wonderful thing. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. It's the Lockbox. Our fund drive begins June 2nd. That's Monday, and we hope to, you know, if we're lucky, fill the whole lockbox and have no fund drive. Thanks to Constance in North Chatham, New York. Thanks to everybody who's done something this morning.
Yeah, you know what? We are angry. Many of us are angry about things, but we can channel that anger into taking one step forward. You know why? Because if you register that you're supporting WAMC, it's one more shareholder in this public corporation that says, I'm with you. I'm going to support you. And right now you could become a sustainer, $5 a month or more, and you can start to give to WAMC on a regular basis. That allows us to budget way easier. We can count on some money coming in a time when we can't necessarily count on the federal government to come through. We could really use some extra from you at WAMC.org or simply call 1-800-323-9262 and connect with a lovely staff member or volunteer.
We are heading back to the roundtable panel, David, but we're at $292,285. Let's get that number up there while you listen to Teresa and Mark and Sarah, discuss things. Feel free to write panel at WAMC.org, but also feel free to make your pledge into the lockbox at 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc in studio this morning with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. He has a name. When I threw to break, I said, an investment banker on Wall Street. The end. It's Mark Whitman, everybody, a regular panelist whose name I do know. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. And we have a few letters that we would like to bring into the conversation. This from Alice, who says, what is the current situation for Afghans in the U.S. with asylum status? What should they do and what protection do they have? Thank you all for the wonderful WAMC group and all that you do.
Asylum is another target, unfortunately, of the Trump administration. Asylum was severely restricted under the first Trump administration. In particular, they went after cases involving domestic violence, which has long been a back and forth issue in terms of the level of protection afforded to survivors of domestic violence under asylum law. So, the asylum system is also deeply broken, like everything else in our immigration system. There was a book that's actually pretty old now, but still rings true, called Refugee Roulette, that talked about the irregularities and how asylum decisions are made by immigration judges, and found that if you draw in the immigration judge lottery a female judge, you're more likely to get asylum, for example. I think John Oliver also did a pretty great bit on, he has such great immigration bits. That's where I go.
The team working on Last Week Tonight, which is an HBO ostensibly comedy show, is the research team on that show is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's enviable.
Yeah, they're
what they dig into and unearth.
Yeah, I sometimes show them in class because they are legitimately correct. It's not only sadly hilarious, it's also factually correct. He has highlighted how it depends on what region of the country that you're in, whether or not you'll get asylum. There's no mistake. There were colleagues of mine, Leila Hlass, and one of her colleagues down in Louisiana at Tulane, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week about why a bunch of folks are being sent to the Louisiana detention facilities. And it's because they're not that far off from the Salvadoran hole that the Venezuelans are trapped in. So, you know, all of this is intentional, and it's intentionally built to strip people of rights on a racist basis. So asylum seekers are entering that system and having to prove that their suffering matters.
Didn't Biden, at the end of the administration, significantly limit asylum as well? Wasn't that his trick for getting border crossings down?
He sure did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is what he did different than what Trump's doing now in terms of the levers that he pulled?
So the law that Biden was, ushered through was originally, I believe that law was originally created under Trump era. The first Trump administration.
45.
That's correct.
And then he made it worse, Biden.
He didn't pass any legislation.
Mark,
he invoked it. Is that correct?
Yeah. So you just say that what Trump's doing now is worse, what Biden did is worse than the things Trump are doing now. Seriously? You really mean that?
No, I appreciate the chance to clarify. I'm not.
He didn't say that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you said that.
But he paved the way, especially in the minds of Americans, right? So, like, there are people.
Which he? Biden.
Oh, sorry, Biden and Trump. I mean, Trump to a much worse degree, right? But Biden didn't help. I mean, the Biden administration is largely the reason why I decided to shift my career towards almost exclusively policy at this point, because it was so devastating to have all of the power levers in place to make change happen for immigrants in this country and have had really hardworking immigration experts inside the White House that we knew would be able to advise that administration on the better way to course correct, and it was ignored.
It couldn't get a bill passed.
It wasn't just that. There's a lot that the executive could have done and did not do. A lot. I mean, you're seeing the outcome of that now, where Trump is doing whatever he wants. I'm not saying that's what Biden should have done, but there were many opportunities for course correction under the Biden administration. And lots of high-ranking immigration experts very publicly left the administration very early on because he was not bold enough to do the minimum to help the immigration situation. It was devastating. And then to see people like Democrats, like Mayor Adams, then take up this mantle of using immigrants as a political football. And most recently, Gavin Newsom in California being very public about wanting to restrict the health care benefits that Californians voted to provide to undocumented immigrants because it's too expensive, and very publicly laying, you know, financial burden, the financial crises in the budget in California on the shoulders of immigrants.
Well, and right now the president of the United States, Donald Trump, is on the Hill advocating that the House push through this reconciliation bill. And one of the key things that he's talking about is that we need these Medicaid cuts, and because we need to get waste and abuse. And the waste and abuse that they point to is the fact that immigrants are getting Medicaid coverage. Now, of course, people who are here in this country, they're going to go to a hospital, and they're going to get sick. They're going to go to a hospital, and they need to be covered in some way. One way or the other, they're going to get medical care. But if he gets his way, they're going to get it in the worst way possible. And I say this to him and Newsom. But yes, Newsom wants to do some of this in California, but Trump and the Republicans want to do it all over the country. And so, and the result will be, you know, they're going to, well, anyway, I interrupted you, but.
Yeah, no, that's all right. And I'm just trying to find the most recent polls, but the vast majority of Americans don't agree with any of this. every single poll that comes back shows that the majority of Americans support a lawful path to permanent citizenship or residency for immigrants in this country. And that's because they are our neighbors. They are our congregants. They are our business makers. They are our artists. That everybody knows a person who's in this country with or without status, or will encounter them in their lifetime. And so, you know, we need to do a better job of voicing that support, because otherwise these politicians are just going to keep doing what they've been doing for decades.
The country needs comprehensive immigration reform. And I think that there was some effort by the last administration, because they were legislatively focused, to try to get to that point. The Trump administration doesn't appear to have any focus on true, thoughtful legislation. And so I don't see the country getting to comprehensive immigration legislation reform under this group, because they think that they can just operate by executive order. And that's how they're operating. They're not doing the hard work of trying to build a consensus around a comprehensive immigration bill.
Sarah mentioned very many minutes ago at this point voluntary deportation, and there is a current story about voluntary deportations. I don't know if that ought to be in quotes or not. I will set it up and we will talk about this for a bit. The United States sent 68 immigrants to Honduras and Colombia back to their countries on Monday for the first government-funded flight of what the Trump administration is calling voluntary deportations. In the northern Honduras city of San Pedro Sula, 38 Hondurans, including 19 children, disembarked from the charter flight carrying $1,000 debit cards from the U.S. government and the offer to one day be allowed to apply for legal entry into the U.S. Sarah, what do we think about these voluntary deportations?
So I think this is what historians and scholars point to as one of the big signs of a tyrannical, authoritarian, fascist regime taking hold, which is anticipatory compliance. And anticipatory compliance is the idea that rather than face consequences that the regime is threatening, individuals will comply with their desires. So in this case, Trump wants immigrants to leave the country, and so he's incentivizing this two ways. One, being very public about what happened to the Venezuelans, making sure that everybody saw the images of the horrible conditions in El Salvador, to scare everyone, and then saying, but you have an out if you don't want to end up in El Salvador thousands of miles away from legal counsel or your family. You can just leave on your own. Some folks might take what's called voluntary departure. I mentioned that earlier. TBD what the cost will be, both to the country in terms of, you know, we have a declining population in the United States. This is a global phenomenon. I heard a story on NPR about it yesterday.
Thanks for listening.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
I love the station.
WAMC.org to pledge anytime.
You should too. Yes. The population's in decline in lots of Western countries, actually, and in a way where we can't replace ourselves. And that's a problem for, you know, human extinction. So the idea is immigration is actually a partial solution to that problem. As birth rates decline in the country, bringing people in to fill the gap between the aging population that we have and then the births that are happening, seems like a no-brainer. And for lots of reasons, including the overt racism of the Trump administration's policies across the board, that's not going to happen in the next several years, but anticipatory compliance in terms of self-deportation is, you know, sort of the opposite of that, getting rid of as many people as possible so that he can claim victory at the end of the term, as he's arguing probably for a third term, right? The goal is to get reelected a third time.
What was interesting to me in that article tucked away in there was two paragraphs I was fascinated by, which is for all of the Trump administration's bluster about what they're doing, so the number of Hondurans deported from the U.S. so far this year is below last year's pace. According to the Honduran immigration officials, 13,500 Hondurans been deported from the U.S. this year. And at this time last year, 15,000 in 2024. So it's interesting to me, you know, lots of bluster, but what's the data behind it and what's the cost? And at what point, to your point, at what point does the business community say this is a problem for us? What point does the agriculture community say this is a problem for us?
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will, of course, continue discussing immigration stories as they are unearthed. And of course, we'll definitely bring them up when Sarah Rogerson is on the panel to educate us with her expertise. Let us now discuss the latest on the struggle to pass Donald Trump's second term agenda in Congress. President Donald Trump is on the Hill today trying to push through the bill. This from The Atlantic. The struggle to pass Donald Trump's second-term agenda in Congress has never been between Republicans and Democrats. The minority party has very little role in the effort so far. Instead, it's been a battle between the House and Senate GOP, between moderates and hardliners, and most salient, between Republicans and reality. Any straightforward accounting points to one conclusion: the president's bill would make the country's fiscal situation worse. It would slash taxes for years to come, and although it would make some budget cuts, they aren't anywhere near enough to cover the difference. The bill is projected to add trillions of dollars to the deficit. The only real disagreement among analysts is how many trillions. Yet Republican leaders keep trying to pretend otherwise. The past few days have seen a flurry of activity on the bill. On Friday, the House Budget Committee failed to advance the bill after Republican fiscal hawks voted against it. Representative Chip Roy pointed out that the plan relies on a lot of upfront spending and claims cuts based on future actions that Congress is unlikely to take. Mark.
So I thought this was a great article, and maybe I should apologize to the listenership. Back in 2022, there was something now referred to as the guilt crisis, and the guilt as in government bonds from the UK. And their markets all went crazy when at the time, Liz Truss put out what she called what they call a mini budget, and it showed deficits in the UK climbing. And basically the markets in the UK and internationally said, boy, the UK is a lot less safer of a bet than we thought. And for other structural reasons, the markets went crazy for 3 days. We're seeing the markets now start to gag on the prospect of this budget passing in the United States. So I just want to make it really clear to listeners. On the left, there's been an argument for a long time that amongst some that the deficits don't matter. I will tell you, I haven't found a credible person on Wall Street, if frankly anyone on Wall Street, who believes that. And the markets, even in the last couple of days, have started to sort of gag on what's been suggested. So you're seeing the fact that not only is this administration degrading the United States through our trade policy, but we're accentuating that through our fiscal policy. And it'll be interesting to see. Donald Trump, in a way, is become a predator on the Republicans' historical claim that they were more fiscally responsible. I'm not really sure it was ever true if you look back to Reagan and others. But we as the United States will pay a dear cost if we continue down the road that they're suggesting and we do not get our fiscal house in order. And for Republicans to pretend otherwise, that we've sort of doged our way into enough savings to indulge the kind of expenditures, well, to the kind of tax cuts that Donald Trump wants, is frankly purely absurd. The one thing that I hold out some hope with respect to is that moderate Republicans, and some of whom are in New York, there's a lot of entropy for them to hold out, because if this new legislation isn't passed, the old tax cuts sunset. So they're in a strategically better position than they might have been if the mechanics were otherwise. But I thought the Atlantic article did a good job of basically drilling in on the fact that this is the Republicans trying to drive up our fiscal deficit and then also tuck in some pretty pernicious legislation as well into this package that Trump is trying to get through both houses of Congress now.
Teresa?
So just a little fact check here, Mark, and I just double check this. Since 1980, all Republican presidents have seen an increase in the federal deficits during their time in office, and the two Democratic administrations since 1980 saw a decrease in the federal deficits, with Bill Clinton even achieving a surplus. So while the Republicans talk about being deficit hawks, the data goes in the opposite direction. So
yeah.
just to clarify,
Teresa, you and I are in league on the fact that Republicans have been as much profligate spenders or as they've been. They've driven up the deficit as much, if not more, than Democrats. One thing I would caution is I'm a little bit loath to use those particular measures, because some of the tax receipts in the first and second years of any administration are based on legislation which exists before. And I just always want to highlight that, because that is a huge problem when we attribute, you know, the current weather today to the current president. I think it's a fallacy that Joe Biden suffered from with the inflation that happened during his watch. It wasn't by and large his cause. He didn't cause it. You and I are agreeing, though. There's no evidence that Republicans are more fiscally responsible than Democrats. And if you go back to Ronald Reagan, there's a good argument to be made that
it's just the opposite.
Right.
And that while, Clinton did control spending, but he did it in a much different way than what Trump is claiming to do now and approaching. So I do think that I'd love to hear you talk about the Moody's rating, because I do think that not only is their data wrong, but they're lying about their data, and they're lying about the implication. The Trump administration is lying about, or I think being misleading about, what the Moody's downgrading means. And then, you know, yesterday at the White House press briefing, the press person said, "Oh no, there aren't going to be deficits in this bill," which is completely untrue. They're going to be in the trillions of dollars, and the only question is how high are they going to be. And the way they cover that is they're going to say, "Well, we anticipate growth," but the amount of growth that would be required was what, $2.5 trillion in growth, but there's no projection that there will be growth. But I also think that the budgets are all a choice of about spending priorities. And it just worries me that a lot of their spending priorities put us in a direction of downward economic spiral, not growth. The most egregious of those, I think, is the cuts in investments in university-based research or NIH research. When you decimate the research, our research community and our universities, that's where, you know, through research is where the next thing comes from, the next iteration, the next innovation, and that's where it gets translated. And it's also where your prepared workforce, your science, technology, engineering workforce comes, and that's what drives the economy. So they're disinvesting in that which sparks economic growth, right? And at the same time, they're in this trade war that just seems at best haphazard, and that's going to drive away customers. Canada, other places are going to go in other directions. So there's a whole cascading series of events that I keep talking about that seem to be driving the economy downward. At the same time, they're pushing this budget that it decimates healthcare. Millions and millions of people will lose their healthcare. It reverses gains in infrastructure. And infrastructure not only improves our roads, our bridges, our way of life, but it also creates jobs for those who need it, right? They say they're going to enhance the manufacturing community, but they're cutting education funding to prepare people to work in manufacturing, right? So it just, to me, lots of cuts, not a lot of coherence, and investments in things that don't get us the growth that they will need. It just puts us in a downward spiral, and the markets reflect that, and Moody's reflects that.
Teresa Bourgeois, Sarah Rogerson, and Mark Whitman are our panel this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. A brief break, and we will return with our last segment of this morning's panel. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue, here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. The lockbox is open. You can pledge anytime at WAMC.org. And while you're on your device and you are listening, if you'd like to shoot us an email, that email address is panel@WAMC.org. We are discussing the bill, the domestic agenda bill that is on the Hill, trying to make its way through Congress over the last week and a half or so. Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, I'm just looking. Budgets are moral documents, as Teresa correctly pointed out. And I was looking at a summary of the big, beautiful bill by Proskauer. And
One big, beautiful bill.
It's a marketing term.
Of course it is.
I know it's killing me. Poor Sarah. I keep harassing it.
That's
not
okay.
Use those phrases.
That is what they're calling it. But
beauty is subjective.
We can.
I didn't say I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's beautiful either. I tried to impersonate Donald Trump on the ride-in and did a terrible job. Ended up sounding like Bill Clinton. But on the big, beautiful bill.
Those are two pretty different impressions.
Two different impressions, yeah. I know. Don't quit my day job. But I was looking at some of the things that this does, and, the reason, there are lots of reasons why people are going to be distracted by the smoke and mirrors, because some people might see more money in their pocket, which is really what people are concerned. Some people, a lot of people are concerned about, who are sort of in the moderate category of voters. There are horrible, terrible things happening, right, in terms of like reducing the credits for renewable energy, all kinds of things that are not great for our kids and our kids' kids. But I was curious about what happened with the child tax credits. And they are making the child tax credit permanent and temporarily increasing the maximum tax credit. And then something I didn't know what was happening, and I find slightly disturbing, is the creation of MAGA accounts.
Yes.
Kids born between 2025 and 2028 get $1,000 in a MAGA account that follows them around, presumably for their lifetime. That's right. This connects to the NPR story I was listening to. These have been tried by other countries. Little incentives like this to try to get women to have more children in order to fill the gap in terms of population renewal that we refuse to fill with immigration. And they don't work. They haven't worked in any other country that has tried them.
In what is $1,000 going to do? What is that going to cover? Like nothing.
Nothing.
Okay.
Not a thing.
No.
Adoption tax credits, family and medical leave credits expanded. And these things sound good, but the issue is that they're temporary, far from sufficient stopgap measures that make it sound like this budget is pro-family when it really truly isn't. For lots of reasons, including that, $1,000 here, $2,500 there. When you're talking about raising a family in this economy, doesn't go very far.
If your family has been surviving on Medicaid and loses Medicaid, $1,000 is not going to cover that instance. Mark.
It probably won't even cover one prescription.
By the way, the reason I should apologize to listeners, I probably didn't finish that thought, was because I didn't realize what a harbinger of our own situation that the market disruption in the UK would be, that when the markets start to not like the deficits you're running, and there's been this perennial question or around in the United States, which is how big a budget deficit can we run and how much debt can the U.S. government run up? Where's the limit? And the answer, unfortunately, is you're not going to know until the markets tell you. And the markets are going to tell you under the worst set of conditions, because they're going to otherwise not like the general business environment. And then they're going to say the United States has gone too far, which means you'll have to be cutting our deficit and views of future deficits sort of at the worst time if we don't get to it ourselves. I wanted to highlight one thing. There was this lot of discussion about the in the bill, whether or not they'll increase the severity of the work requirement around I'm going to get it
Medicaid.
Wrong. Medicaid. Thank you. And I saw this beautiful discussion of it, which I think highlights the cross currents that happen. So if you're a Republican, you think, well, people who aren't trying to work should be cut off. But what's the problem when you actually install that? Most of the people who get cut off for reasons of basically paperwork. They can't fill it in or don't turn it in on time. Then what happens? Medicaid gets cut. They don't end up they don't keep up with regular hospital visits or medication, and they end up on a more expensive form of health care, which in the case of these individuals, the government pays the bulk of anyway. So good or bad idea, putting work requirements in. Probably not that much of a pickup and maybe actually expensive, except for one fact. There are U.S. states, there are a few red states that still haven't joined Medicaid. And if you put the work requirement in, it's probably the case that these states will have sort of the political cover than to join in the Medicaid, which they should have been in forever. Now, personally, I believe, and I think it was either there was a governor's race where this was a big issue, either Mississippi or Alabama.
Arkansas.
Was it Arkansas? Thank you. Tells you what I think of that part of the South, but that's my own mental infirmity.
I think that's what you're talking about. They tested the work requirements. It ended up not working.
Oh, no. It wasn't Arkansas. There was a governor's race where this was a big deal. And the problem was you hear about the life of people without this safety net in those states, and it is just horrific. But if they join, the program will become considerably more expensive in aggregate, but because people are joining. So the question is, if you're an advocate for more poor people being on it, the work requirement seems like a horrible idea, probably expensive, but it does seem like something. And by the way, the numbers of people who end up being subject to that work requirement is pretty limited. The number of people who would join when the red states join would be even greater, and you would finally offer assistance to people that I believe should have been offered assistance for a long time. So the question is it better or worse to put the work requirements in place from an aggregate perspective? There are lots of cross currents with all these issues.
You know what does work? A universal basic income without work requirements.
Well, and evidence that the work requirements and all of these things are not going to be well received is that this is the fight that's going on right now. The Republicans are not putting them into effect until after the election. If they felt that they were going to work and that people weren't going to hate them, they would have put them in before the election, but they've bumped them till after the election.
Correct.
And really, all of this comes down to priorities. They have cut incentives for clean energy, but they haven't touched the incentives for oil and gas, for instance, because they got a lot of money from the oil and gas folks. They have deeply cut into food security, but they haven't cut the deduction, the business lunch deduction, where you get half of your lunch, you can deduct it. So it's all about priorities.
We are out of time for this morning. I thank you all, as always, for your time and expertise and for your compassion for your fellow citizens. That's not bad either. Teresa Bourgeois, Sarah Rogerson, Mark Whitman made up the panel this morning. We will return with more Roundtable after this.